some words of introduction. I'm Les Sands. I live and practice in Ipswich, which is 25 miles west of Brisbane. And I'm in general practice with a group of five of us, four GPs, and one consultant physician. I've been in Ipswich since the beginning of 63. It's an old established practice. I'm the only committed Christian in the group. The other fellows are good guys, but not committed Christians. Has problems and advantages as far as Christian work and practice is concerned. I'm also involved with the family medicine program. I'm the area coordinator for the Ipswich area, and also quite involved with the church work. I'm church secretary for our church, also a Sunday school teacher, so that keeps me quite busy. Unfortunately, this is the first day I've been able to attend the conference, because up until yesterday afternoon I've been away on holidays, and just got back late yesterday afternoon. I'm glad to be here now. Now, if we could have each of you telling us a little bit about yourselves so we know who's who, and bring a bit more freedom to discussion.
Right. I'm John. This is my wife, June Jacarino. We come from Melbourne. I'm general practitioner there. I'm in a partnership of four, all of whom are Christians. We have assistants, I think about four assistants as well. I also participate in the family medicine program, and our general practice has been established about 11 years from scratch, and the average age of our partners would be about 34, of our patients would be about 30-34, so it's a young family community.
I'm just here as just help out surgery, so I'm not
a very important person.
Thank you.
I'm Jane Levy. I come from New South Wales and practice in the Blue Mountains, about 35 kilometres west of Sydney. I've been in association for 12 months with a lass who's a Roman Catholic lass. She's been in practice here for about 10 years. And we work about two-thirds to three-quarters time each. The two of us in practice then. Okay.
We're Neil and Jean Campbell, and I practice in Strathfield in Sydney, where I've been for 30 years, and I've been in general practice now for 40 years. So we've had a fair bit of experience in it. And we have a group of four in which we work.
Oh, Christian.
And which is a very good group in my view. We'll talk more about that later.
I'm his wife.
And another very important person.
Oh, yes, I have a role.
I'm Mark Crone, it's my name. I'm in the family medicine program here in Queensland, and I've graduated 4 years now, and I've done 3 years in hospital positions, and I'm presently working at the Inala Health Centre as part of one of the FMP terms there.
And,
I'm Mary Sewell from Levin, just north of Wellington in New Zealand. I'm in about a three-quarter time private practice in a group with six other doctors, one of whom is a Christian besides myself. I've been in this practice over the last 14 years or so, initially just as a locum because I have a large family and married to an agriculturalist. Now that my family is nearly grown up, I am more involved in the practice. I'm a partner but not a financial partner.
And I'm Ken McFarlane. I'm a house surgeon. I'm from New Zealand, from Gisborne. I'm working in the hospital at the moment, but my ultimate aim is general practice.
All right, well, get myself connected back up here again. Any all sorts of loud noise comes from, I think. What I propose to do is to have a short talk And then the talk is going to raise a number of questions. What I'd like you to then to decide is which questions you'd like to discuss. And we can then make a list of the questions that you want to discuss and then proceed to spend some time with each of the questions. Does that format seem to be okay as far as you're concerned? Actually, that's all right. Coming today as leader of this particular elective has got, for me and for you, both advantages and disadvantages. Because I've been unable to attend the other sessions, I've got no knowledge of what has been said. Now, that's a disadvantage. However, by not knowing what has already gone on before, I can perhaps be somewhat less inhibited in the comments, and what is said may hopefully be a summing up of the conference thought. There's just a slight possibility that together we might be able to come up with some fresh insight, so that'd be worthwhile. The fact that this story is reported by Matthew, Mark and Luke testifies to its authenticity and importance. Jesus told many parables, of course, with the intention of teaching his disciples and us valuable lessons. But this is a real life story as it happened, and I personally get rather upset sometimes that the writers of the Bible books didn't give us a lot more detail about some of the things that went on. But we do in fact have a fair bit of detail about this particular story, and it certainly is a real life story, just as it happened. The Pharisees and the Herodians, representing the opposite poles of theological and political influence, were a most unlikely combination. A modern day example would be if we had the IRA joining forces with Ian Paisley's group for some common purpose, such as talking Margaret Thatcher out of her economic policies. That'd be the sort of equivalent of having the Herodians and Pharisees getting together. Each group represented opposite answers to their trick question. If Jesus advised the giving of tribute to the Romans, the Pharisees would have him. If he advised against it, the Herodians would have him. Now, Jesus gave a very clever answer, which of course is our conference theme. Render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's. It was clever for several reasons. It was clever because it enabled him to avoid the trap which had been so carefully set. And we can enjoy the humour of the situation. I mean, you can just picture how absolutely flabbergasted those questioners were at finding that their trap had been turned back on them. It's clever because it was more than just a piece of one-upmanship. And if only they had followed it through, if they'd been really interested in getting at the truth of the matter, and if they'd followed it through, they would have had real answers to their dilemmas. The dilemmas were there, and they were genuine dilemmas for the different groups, but they were using it as a trick question. And if only they'd followed it through, they'd had answers. But it's clever because Jesus was able to use a difficult situation to very efficiently and effectively teach us today a very important spiritual truth. It's important to keep that in mind. Jesus laid down a great principle of far-reaching application and permanent value concerning the relationship between the church and the state. He gave us a neat guideline for determining where our personal priorities should lie. Duty to God and the state are not incompatible. We owe a debt to both, and it is certainly possible to be a good Christian and a good citizen. Considering the relevant application of this topic, it's certainly possible to be a good Christian and a good general practitioner. However, before dealing more specifically with general practice, There's a couple of other points I want to make. Jesus stated that those who use Caesar's coin should not refuse to pay Caesar's tribute. Every citizen receives certain privileges through being part of the community, and therefore every citizen has a duty to pay for those privileges, whether in cash or service or both. If we tie this thought in with Romans chapter 13, Paul says, "Let every person be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and those that exist have been instituted by God." A bit further down he says, "Therefore, one must be subject not only to avoid God's wrath, but also for the sake of conscience. For the same reason you also pay taxes, for the authorities are ministers of God, attending to this very thing. Pay all of them their dues, taxes to whom taxes are due, revenue to whom revenue is due, respect to whom respect is due, honour to whom honour is due." So, those who use Caesar's coin should not refuse to pay Caesar's tribute. And this should not interfere with what is due to the King of Kings and Lord of Lords, in whose image we are all made, and whose superscription we all bear. In that passage I read from Romans 13, the very next few verses, I believe, are highly significant. Reading from verse 8 downwards, it says, "Owe no man anything except to love one another, for he who loves his neighbour has fulfilled the law. The commandments: you shall not commit adultery, you shall not kill, you shall not steal, you shall not covet, and any other commandment are summed up in this sentence: you shall love your neighbour as yourself." That, of course, is quoting Jesus himself when he stated the greatest commandment was, "Thou shalt love the Lord thy God," and the second was like it, "Thou shalt love thy neighbour as thyself." Love is a fulfilling of the law. Question: do you feel much love in your heart as you sign your income tax check each year? How much love do you feel in your heart at that particular moment? There was, of course, another taxation question in Matthew chapter 17, verse 24. Peter was asked by the collectors of the temple tax if Jesus paid that tax. In typical impetuous fashion, Peter answered yes. And then he went home to check the facts. Once back at home, Jesus challenged him with a hypothetical question. "What do you think, Simon? From whom do the kings of the earth take toll or tribute? From their sons or from others?" And Peter said, "From others." Whereupon Jesus said to him, "Then the sons are free." Now, this tax was an unjust imposition by the Jewish authorities themselves. They had no legal right to extract it. Actually, I could use the word either exact or extract there. Either word would be quite correct. The law required a tithe or a tenth and no more. And this temple tax was imposed over and above that. Now we get into some sticky questions. Are we as Christians obligated to pay all our taxes without complaint? To what extent can we morally minimise our taxes? For the Christian, what is the difference between tax avoidance and tax evasion? Each week, almost each day, the doctor receives mail advice concerning some new tax scheme. Now, are any of these schemes okay for the Christian? Which? Why? Jesus clearly regarded this temple tax as being illegitimate. But he paid it. And the reason is rather interesting why he paid it. The Bible tells us he paid it in order not to give offence to them. In other words, he was showing love to his neighbour. And sometimes we should render to Caesar not because we have to, but as an aid to our witness, so that we can glorify his name. Taxes are the obvious thing that we think of in reading the story. However, I'd like to suggest that there are other areas where there may be conflict of interests, where we may have to decide on priorities, and especially relevant to general practice. What about the rights and interests of the patient when they conflict with those of society? It happens, doesn't it? Have you ever written an SP or authority script that was not strictly in accordance with either the letter or the spirit of the law? For the New Zealanders, we've got this pharmaceutical benefits book, and we can prescribe according to the limits in the book, except if it's written in red. If it's written in red, some of the things have to be for a specified purpose. For example, beclomethasone has to be for intractable asthma, and other things have to be authority things for Grisier Fullman. You have to send for an authority for proven fungus infection of certain categories that obviously you have to get a pathology test in order to prove that. But sometimes there's a temptation to short circuit and not worry too much about the proof. Okay, have any of us ever written an SP or authority script that was not strictly in accordance with either the letter or the spirit of the law? Have you ever given the patient the benefit of the doubt when writing work and compensation certificates? Have you ever agonised over whether a patient with a notifiable disease should be so notified? An unmarried girl requests the pill. What are your responsibilities as a Christian doctor? Another girl requests an abortion. Should the Christian GP hold up his hands in self-righteous horror? Should he piously wash his hands of the problem and send her off to Children by Choice? What should he do? A young man requests vasectomy. An old man wants help to end his life. How do these questions fit in with our obligations to God or Caesar? What about time? How much of your time do you owe to God? How much of your time do you give to God? What about the conflicting demands of your time, by your practice, your church, and your family? Which of us here has never used our practice as an excuse for being late when there was no need to be late? Or an excuse for non-attendance at some function that we didn't want to really go to anyway? Let's get back to the question of money. Tithing was compulsory for the Jew. The law said that a tenth of income belonged to God, and that was that. As Christians, we are not under the law, but under grace. Nevertheless, many Christians use the tithe as at least a guide as to how much we should give to God. But here's the question. Should we give a tenth of gross income, a tenth of taxable income, or a tenth of income after tax? So, we've raised a number of questions. What I'd like to do now is just make a list of the questions that you would like to discuss and talk about, and then we can make a list of priorities and see which order we want to talk about them in, and then proceed from there. What I'll do, I'll make a list up on the overhead transparency so we can see these as they are. Okay, so we'll put that well down the list at the present time. Well, I saw the list of tapes that were available, having seen the list of tapes, I ordered that particular tape. I think it sounds that it's quite useful. Well, there's no need to confine yourself to those questions that I've raised there. You may have other questions you want to discuss, particularly relevant to general practice. Well, I'm looking in on.
I just thought that that question. I can't remember the exact phrasing with regard to the person who what is compensation certificate to the unmarried girl, but the old man who, or his family wanted to see the old man.
Okay. So certificate.
And I suppose that's just a kind of airport issue because I wasn't here. This was also in our first morning.
So certificates, the old man.
It's the scripts I find the problem because there is often a conflict between the patient's interests and the
descriptions.
And also I'm particularly interested in what is tax evasion, minimisation, avoidance, being in the advocate for this. Escalating income and escalating provisional tax.
Okay, certificates, old man, basically euthanasia, prescriptions, tax evasion, tax avoidance.
I think that one question I'd like to be talked about is the time business. After as Christians, we don't just give some of that time to God, all of that time is God. Mm-hmm. It's a matter of how do we see the stewardship of our time in relation, not just to our prayer.
That's
to our family
and
to our own bodily health.
That's
an important point. Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's particularly relevant to busy practitioners.
Yeah.
Because it's terribly easy to look at a person or to look at your practice and the needs of practice and think, for the compassionate view, well, that's where I should be.
Mm-hmm.
But we still have a responsibility to live within the physical framework we've been given.
There's a practical point that should you push yourself beyond that, you're no use with rehabilitations.
Okay, now any other areas you would like to discuss? The ones I've got certificates, the old man, euthanasia, prescription. Oh, someone mentioned the married girl. And the pilgrim. Yeah, prescriptions, tax evasion, tax avoidance, stewardship of the time, unmarried girl and the pilgrim. Excuse the writing. Yeah, well now, what order would you like to discuss them in? Which would you like to get Eric to talk about first?
I think we all want the other person to give the answer.
Very, in my recent years, Crosser, in a very bad, in a sort of reverse sort of way. Granddad was in terminal pneumonia, he was in hospital, he's 75, and the girl was coming to see him, and they all
put him in that bad so he's getting worse and worse, and they all come to the
whole clan comes, all over comes, so.
And then Grandma says, oh yeah, turn for the better, and then you say, we'd all want to help, of course. But he was suffering a lot, isn't he? Where's the disease? I mean, it's terrible. He's got tears coming down. You know. It's always really necessary.
I can get this sort of situation. I think it's different from the
situation where the person is dying.
have us resign and then pay.
And that situation.
That situation was brothers are upset and genuinely upset.
And the patient's not upset for the amount of pain. And the ongoing tragedy of the person disintegrating. And I think in that situation, it's a slightly different one. Because there's no hope of cure of that person. And without due, I've always taken it in this situation as the relief of pain is paramount. And that that shortens the person's time
to that. I've got that with a patient sometimes.
And I often develop it.
Always.
That's a course I take. But in the other situation, I'm really back out around that way
without order or not, whether or not grandpa should be allowed to sit alive or anything else. Although, it's much you wonder why we were quite away that we let go and take a long time. It's going to happen.
Yeah, well, any would like to comment on that?
Basically twofold. We have very few middle aged people. We have a lot of young families who are very elderly. And about half our work is very elderly. Around the 3 nursing homes during the week. And I've had to keep quite a few over the last 2 weeks elderly people in nursing homes. I had a couple, particularly this year, within myself. There are a few, some of the elders that are in there, you know, day after day, week after week, month after month, they're in the nursing home. Not enjoying any quality of life themselves. Often, not just, any support of any benefits. I say I received a lot of insight into some, both at this conference and also in reading Joan Erickson's book, A Step Further, where she talks about the fact that, the world, and Ralph's been talking about this, the world is not just as we see it, we just see one part of the community. And one of the things I had observed in one of the teaching rooms I go to with Ralph at the Christian lesson, where the it was sort of all, who came about the week that it isn't medical stuff. The degree of compassion that these girls exhibited towards these patients who, literally had no contact with reality, they could be inspired, no way you could communicate except by touch, and you had no idea of how much they comprehended. And it's actually unresponsive. And yet the nurses, they were beautiful, they have found these sort of techniques, and if they think to indicate discomfort, we can get out there with some challenges. And one of the things that Jenny Erickson brought out in her book was that sometimes there may be no purpose for suffering in that, for that person. But if there was never any suffering, there would never be an opportunity for people to show compassion. And that also what was observed here, it wasn't all that was going on, but also the angels of the spirit world, who also said,
without any pressure from outside or anyone else. You're talking about compassionate nurses. and I find I point you're talking about people who are moribund anyway.
Well, these ones anyway. I have a different attitude to saying that the patient needs to kneel with a young man. Leading a conversation with the relative, and usually once pain becomes a problem, I start believing, of course, that morphine, oral morphine, not the rotten contact, crossbowing, the oral morphine station, which is an organization of prescription.
I think we all have our methods dealing with every individual case that has been told by the man particularly. I think the point of the problem is probably the point of the objective is where we really want to be in this case.
What do you think Dr. Jesus would do in the situation that John has mentioned, where relatives are creating pressure?
Well, I think that as I've just mentioned, members are seated, other things are seated. In the God. Basically, render the seed as a thing that are seeded at this point of view. I would find it hard to take the view that I've got to, in any way, whilst that one to his eternal home. One, because it's against the law of the land, number one, and against our allegiance which we took when we graduated. I'm not being clear on that. We all do this sort of thing in one way or another.
I agree with you. I think that in case like that, I would clearly have to say to the relatives, well, I feel that as a doctor, my purpose is to do as much for your grandfather as possible within the limits of his own physical weakness and so on. Where there is not a tender but I'm constantly surprised at what God does in spite of us and in spite of our great preconceptions of what is going to happen. You know, I can think now, last year a crisis occurred in my life. My mother was had a sudden heart attack in the night. She developed an arrhythmia. She was moribund. My colleagues worked on her, took her to the base hospital. She was they tried cardioversion several times. Now, my mother was nearly 80. And after about an hour and a half of working on her unsuccessfully, she was unconscious. My physician friend came out and said, well, Murray, we've tried it several times. Do you want us to keep going? And right there and then I had to make a decision. And I said, no, don't keep going. Just leave in God's hands. Well, God saved my mother. She recovered, and the next day was conscious. And I thought, well, now, Lord, you've saved my mother's life. Now, what sort of a life is she going to have? It's just amazing that God was able to take that. Of course, I was praying, as you can imagine. My mother had a hemiplegia. She recovered from the hemiplegia, and within 3 months, she was back home in her flat and living independently. Now, you know, that was, I had really got to the point where I really felt I was saying goodbye to my mother. I have another patient who has a terminal carcinoma, admitted to hospital for terminal nursing care in January of 1980. And against all our predictions and against all the natural acceptance of progression of disease, that woman is still alive. She is bedcase, but she's alert. She still has
she has very little quality of life if you look at it from the point of view of mobility and so on. But there are two important things in that woman's life which I believe God has worked for us because we've prayed for her. One is she's become a Christian. The other is that she's free of pain. She is very weak, very thin, but still alert, still smiling, and still responding to nurses. And she's still alive. Nobody knows why. The whole hospital's been asking why. You know, why is God still healing her there? But she's, in fact, I believe, a testimony to God's ability to do things in people, even in the last few, you know, the last stage of life. I feel myself, you can never, we have not the right to sort of say, no, I won't go any further with this patient, except in the context of terminal care, where I feel we have to give pain relief as the main course of action. But I think that even a person who's 80 or 90 has to be considered. I think operative procedures are able to be performed. I have an 89-year-old guy who's never been in hospital. And he developed an incarcerated hernia. And I couldn't choose it. I sent up to the hospital. The enthusiastic young house surgeon was able, after a great deal of difficulty and an awful lot of pain, I'm sure, reduce his hernia. He said to my old patient, "Well, old chap, you're all right. Now you can go home." "I've no fear," he said. "I'm not going home. My doctor sent me in to have an operation, and I can't operation." Now, as a matter of fact, they admitted him, and he had his hernia repaired. Mm. He was a dear saint of God.
Mm.
At 89, he's now 92. And still praying for me and my family, and taking care of a lot of other people in prayer too.
I think this basically means that we ought to be very careful that we don't usurp the role of God. I mean, often doctors are accused of playing God, and sometimes we do this. And I've certainly, well, just earlier this year, I had a chap who had had two previous strokes. Now he turned up deeply unconscious, bad cardiac arrhythmia with it, and I wrote on his chart in the hospital not to be resuscitated, because I was sure he was going to be dead by morning. And I thought, well, I don't want any nurse hopping in and doing any cardiac massage or anything silly like that under the circumstances, because he's confined to bed anyhow. But next morning he was bright and alert and asking for his breakfast. You get your eye wiped so often in this sort of game, and I think your word is very important, that we need to be careful not to be too certain of ourselves and our diagnoses. I think it's been emphasised that there is a difference between deliberately taking steps to shorten a person's life as compared with not over-treating and forcing the person to stay alive with IV tubes and all sorts of other
yeah.
Yeah,
I mean, I think that's really worked out. One patient up 2 weeks ago, she's fairly crippled at home, but she came loose from her and she woke up the next morning and was using everyone because she then got breakfast, and now I thought she'd taken us, you know.
What a good reason. Get on some of the other issues.
Yeah.
I don't think we want to make this a clinical meeting.
No.
I think it's an elective to deal with some of these problems.
Okay. Well, what would you like to hit next?
I think we get.
Yeah. Okay, the rest of you happy to go to that one next? Tax evasion and tax avoidance. Is there a difference? What is the difference? Which ones do you allow? Actually, I felt rather exercised while preparing this talk because I was in the middle of trying to
do something myself.
I've taken my new accountant, who is a reliable and trustworthy accountant. I don't know whether that's a Christian, but he certainly is a man of Christian principles, and I just left it with him.
Mm-hmm.
So, and he explained the tax avoidance measures that he's taken, the legitimate ones, and I've accepted that he used them in my case. I feel that provided that the work within the laws of the land,
This is the whole crux of the thing, you see. The fellow down the city by the name of Klein, who takes pride in the fact that he's not paid any tax and doesn't pay any tax. He works within the law, and he uses the law to miss out on tax. And he's making a huge fortune in selling his tax schemes to various people. A lot of his ideas sound rather shonky. On the other hand, some of his ideas sound, completely legitimate. Now, for the Christian, what do we allow and what do we not allow? The law allows us to claim a certain proportion of school fees or education fees. Now, that in a sense is tax avoidance, but it's legitimate tax avoidance because the law obviously intends us to be able to claim the education fees. But then there are other situations which are not quite so clear cut, where people may be investing in various areas. Macadamia plantations and various farms of various kinds. Now, for many, these schemes allow certain tax advantages, the big question is whether these tax advantages are legitimate for the Christian or not. Now, for what it's worth, I think some of them are and some of them aren't. Interesting thing is that there's one scheme that one of my partners was rather interested in that I thought sounded very, very shaky, and I wouldn't have a bar of. And I told him about one that I was rather interested in that I thought was quite legitimate, and he wouldn't have a bar of it.
What around motives? Thinking about tax avoidance schemes. What around motives? Get us to get more of the golden dollar for ourselves so that we can do more with it? Or are we doing it for some different motive? After all, everything is done, every television advertisement, everything is done for the verse of the Holy Gospel. Sure, how much do you say? Other things that we're doing, what are those motives? We need to get more money for ourselves, personally. Is it to get more, to be able to give away? And is it, does it comply with the laws of the land? I'm just saying that.
Yeah, I think they're a very important point.
Mm. I think we have to accept that as part of citizens of our country, we owe it to our country to pay some of the income, surely, because these are the basic things.
We enjoy the civilised amenities that we have in our country, and I think as Christians we have to be willing to pay a proportion of our funds. It's how much that we have.
If there's any question about the fact that we're all paying rather high for the privilege. I think also paying highly for the amount of hours that you're working and paying these taxes. I think it probably boils down to the fact that what you do with the money that you have left after tax. I mean, I think it's on everyone's conscience what they did with tax evasion. I mean, if they decide they're going to change these tax evasion schemes, well, surely that's a matter for their conscience to work out if there's tax evasion as opposed to tax
take the voice of the education system, and we're paying for education anyway. So I think any small reduction in the cost of education is well justified as far as I'm concerned. Anyway, we're paying for it, both for the education and we're paying tax, so why not? I think it's purely a matter of the tax evasion schemes are probably what everyone's probably going to look at. But also the what you do with the money that you've got in the country is you channel out in an area that you feel is doing good to other people. It's surely an important issue.
That's a rather, I think, you know, what is the responsible use of money? I mean, it seems to me that you would have what Christ would do. Well, Christ was anti-legalism. It was one of the things that inevitably had him killed, I think. The tax structure is a very stiff legalistic system. It can be made that, like any legalistic system. Christ showed that he's quite content with the Jewish legalistic system. And he was deliberately walking on the Sabbath and this sort of thing. He was more interested in what was behind it all. This is what we have to be more interested in. Not just how do you avoid tax, that's relatively easy. It's what do you do with the money that you earn, what do you use it for, and there are legitimate calls on it. I mean, it's one thing to be a wandering Jew living a very simple life in Palestine. It's another thing to be in a dog-eat-dog society where people depend on one, and where one has got obligations not only to one's family, but also to one's neighbours and to those less fortunate than us. And we're in a position to be able to earn money, which they can't, which can be used, unfortunately. It seems to be the universal tool with which so much good can be done. And I think that in each one, in the councils of each one's mind, there must be a balance point that says, well, look, to rip off another 2,000 so I can go to Hong Kong, for no other good reason to enjoy myself, may be questionable. Whereas, to rip off a 5,000 with a view to using it in some particular need that one sees, like a refuge for unmarried mothers, which the government are completely ignoring. And after all, the government got its priorities right. And should we perhaps be trying to offset the unchristian and anti-Christian sometimes priorities which government set themselves? Are we to accept blindly the fact that government knows how to spend money and use it wisely? Or should we use this system, or exploit the system, to try and compensate?
So basically, I get the message that our whole attitude to money is important and significant, that we've got to be thinking in very much in terms of stewardship of what God has given to us. Part of this taxation thing is tied in with stewardship. I think both of you said that what we do with what we save is quite important. But having said that, we then raise the question, does the end justify the means? the sort of problem that does in fact concern me personally at the moment is with this a rearrangement that I'm doing myself at the present time. Incidentally, my accountant's a Christian too. She's a member of our church, so I find that quite a helpful guide as to what is allowable and what's not allowable. But at the same time, I do wonder, with the scheme at the present time, it will in fact enable me to give considerably more directly to the church. But does that necessarily mean to say it's legitimate for me to indulge in this? And as far as we can gather, it's legally correct. I think it's morally correct. I'm certainly not doing it for my own purposes. I'm very much in mind of welfare of the family and the church and so on. But what sort of guidelines can we use now? Supposing, although I think everything's correct and the lawyer thinks everything's correct and the accountant thinks everything's correct, supposing the taxation commissioner disagrees and takes me to court over it all. Now, the thing that worries me is whether, as a Christian, I should be trying to fight these sort of things in court. Hopefully it never ever comes out, I don't think it will, but these sort of thoughts go through one's mind as to just how...
Well, what makes you think the Commissioner's right? I mean, the Commissioner says that we all these cats decide, the giant power decides, we want X number of yours on them. That is a decision made on policies and whatever. Wants to say that the X amount of dollars that he considers you ought to part up, it should be considered, should be accepted as being, unquestionably, as being the right amount. After all, this is just a cat and mouse game between how much you can get and how much you're prepared to give him.
Yeah.
That's where legalism comes in. There has to be a point where one has to confront the situation and say, well, that amount of tax which I would have to pay, if he paid me all I asked, all he asked, if I paid him all he asked, is too much. Or if it's not too much, well, then pay it. Don't do anything about it. But we all imply that we consider that what John Howard's requesting is too much. Therefore, there must be a figure in our mind which we consider to be a more equitable figure than he's asking. Otherwise, the schemes wouldn't be on. Otherwise, you just write a check and get it.
Do we believe that God directs every detail of our lives, every credit in our bank account? Do we believe that? If we do, and if we believe what Rand has been saying the last couple of days, that this is that umbrella, as we saw, that the whole thing belongs to God. Surely the way to do it is that none of us can lay down guidelines as a generality. There's only one way to do it, sure, that is to come to God in prayer and him humbly and ask him, God, is this right or is it wrong? For you, it might be right. For me, it might be wrong, whatever our motives might be. And I think, surely, this is the way to be. I've got enough beliefs and I've got enough faith in prayer. God's guidance in my life, I've only used to know that if God says, no, that's not for you, if you've got to, it's not right, he'll tell you it's not right. You can drop it aside. I believe this is the only way to tackle it. I don't think we can lay down any real guidelines, any specific ways of whether we should go into a macadamia nuts or anything else. But I think the point is, we've got to bring these things really to God in prayer and to say, Lord, is this going to be your glory? Is it going to be, or is it going to be the my glory? Or is it going to be whatever it is? Let's show me just where my position is and come up with what I'm doing. I think we do that very humbly. And I think that's we'll get the right answer. I've got my faith.
So
it's
terrible.
It's a simplistic way. It's an interesting answer, I know. But I believe it's the only way we as Christians can really approach some of these really difficult problems.
I think another thing that concerns about this issue is that, you hear all this talk about, what should I do? I think myself that we live in a society that is abundantly rich. I mean, in comparison with so much of the rest of the world, and our time's being taken up with these issues, how much are we giving or how much should we give, when there's a whole portion of the world that's just not even a question for them, isn't it? And I think the thing that concerns me about these money issues is that what we're really sort of trying to sort out at the time is how much, money is power. And we don't want to be sort of dependent on other people. And I think God calls us not to sort of worry as much about that. And that's a hard thing for a person who's used to power in the sense of being a doctor and having power over people's lives to actually let go and let, like you were saying, the simplistic view, if we have this overview of God's principles working over all things, take place. And I think if we as individuals and as people in other professions and people in Western society in general could start to take hold of that sort of thing in the Western world, we might be able to make some sort of inroads on what I see as a very worrying problem in terms of the whole world, because these people in these other countries that we sort of occasionally talk about, that we absolve our consciences and that we give to a church, and we think that, I think God calls more than just to sort of unload our money and sort of let someone do. I think he wants our feelings and our emotions and everything else to be concerned for these people. I know we can't sort of all rush over and do it, but while we're sort of worrying about all these schemes and things here, those very people are dying every day, those very people are starving every day, those people are sort of beset by all sorts of problems. And I just think that probably if there was a
a greater sort of concern for that and a willingness to be more, to be literally more humble and to sort of not want to be, you know, the Prime Minister, or not want to be, you know, the, well, I'm going to give this much of my money and all the rest of it. I don't know whether that sort of answers any of the questions, but that's sort of, I think, an important point in that.
What you're proposing then for that, to enter the political sphere so that you can influence where the wealth of our nation is directed. We're saying here, in a way, that we should keep some portion of private wealth so that we can direct it when we think it will be the most good. You're saying the country, we are wealthy, which is true. Therefore, it should follow from what you say, you should be politically involved so that you can in some way influence the destiny of the wealth which the country has.
Well, here's the one
about that a lot. I'm thinking more and more, I don't have
the answers to these things, but now I need to sort of really start to take them up. But I'm starting to think more and more that perhaps, well, for me anyway, it's not a calling into politics, because I don't think that through a human system I'm ever going to be able to sort of see what I think God is calling me to do take place. So I think, you know, politics will have to go its way and business will have to go its way and all the rest. But I feel that I'm being called more to perhaps a more simple life in terms of where I am here and now. And perhaps, in, you know, as an individual, I should be sort of perhaps getting into the church. I think I see the church as the only structure that I guess you can sort of really start to sort of see your relationships with other human beings, and in this sense Christian, sort of live out these principles that you want to do. No, I don't think that I see myself getting into politics as a way of doing it. I think other people have tried that, whether the, I guess sometimes they are successful, sometimes not. But I just feel whenever you try to go through a convention, you know, a structure of this world, the very thing we've been talking about all through the conference takes place. You know, the thing that's pervading society can often rob you of the very, you know, sort of relationship you have with God and himself. And I'm not sort of saying that we should all go back to sort of these communities that lots of different people have tried. But I think if we got into our churches and really went sort of the dead wood on the seat that he was talking about in that lecture, if we really, and we're, I think the biggest problem for me is this ability to actually be humble enough to let other people have a say over my life. I think when I look ahead and sort of see what a lot of people are involved in, I see people who don't want to be controlled by other people. And that's the very essence of Christianity, that you have to be submissive to God. And I think part of this problem that we can't be submissive to one another is part of the same problem in not being able to be submissive to God. And I think this is a sort of a jumble sort of answer to your question, but I sort of see for myself some sort of desire to actually get into a local church, which is the only structure that I can see that there's something that claims to be under God, and to try as an individual in that to learn to be more submissive to one another, to sort of try and direct more money, more energy, and more things to what's a local problem, and also hopefully to the world problem.
Our minister has been very much in favour of what he calls storehouse giving, whereby instead of individuals within the church sending money off to all sorts of various missions and various organisations around the place, bring all the tithes into the storehouse, and then the church distributes in the name of the church to the various organisations there, even if the individual member says, righto, I want you to give $10 for me to such and such a mission. Well, it's still functioning through the church, and I think this might be what the sort of thing you're trying to get at, is it?
Well, I'm just saying, once again, you know the answer to yourself. I just sort of feel like I can see politics as a way of sort of, I guess some person might sort of feel that they're a Christian in politics, they could sort of try and swing the whole the machinery across to sort of giving more. I don't think sort of giving more is necessarily the only answer either. I think perhaps there's going to be a greater call for people to go and physically do things. But I think I see personally, if there was a greater sort of I guess thrust into a local structure like churches, or I guess it's, well, it's one of the sort of few structures that sort of is supposed to be a Christian structure, then that's, you know, a way that you can,
in terms of securities and all these other things. I sort of have wondered myself, I don't know whether you see any opportunity for this, but I mean,
we talk about all these sort of insurance schemes and superannuations and all these business type things. If you have a
real faith in what God was doing in your life, and if you belong to a strong church of caring people, then perhaps all of that wouldn't really be necessary, in the sense that if you do fall, if you do,
I'm not saying be irresponsible either and sort of let other people do it for you. But if you really believe and you really go and you're really a community as God was calling us to be,
then it's almost the ideal of the life
you're after. Surely we're called to make
the life you're after.
Yeah. I just feel that there could be so much more done to do that. And perhaps as we, as everyone threw themselves into that, a lot of these things would disappear at their own accord. I don't know whether that's sort of fallacious thinking or not.
That's the sort of
vision I
sometimes have. I don't know if it's practical.
Unfortunately, if you follow the system where you let God look after you and you don't go into the superannuation or insurance scheme, well, you're not being any better off anyway. The government are only taking out in taxes, so you're not helping anyone. If you could sort of not into those schemes, retain that money and direct it to a needy area, whether it be unmarried mothers or just some of these poverty-stricken people or some of the elderly with them. Your family don't want to look after them in bungalows down in back sheds. I mean, that can be channeled to an area of help, but unfortunately under the system we've got, the government take that anyway. So we've got the choice of either being uninsured or no superannuation. You can't win anyway. I mean, you're going to take it one way or the other.
I'm not saying these things are bad, I'm just sort of throwing ideas around.
Well, I'm just, you know, just
perhaps a combination of the two.
Yes, well, I mean, it'd be great if we could channel that money to some areas.
You made a very sort of fundamental point there. I think I this one, and it was a very, very important one. But if we belong to a caring community, this is what's missing, isn't it? The caring community that, if you were down your luck, would care. Instead of just running away from
Russia, because in the early church, of course, the early church formed its own social security system, and but down through the years, the state has taken more and more of the functions that were previously worked by the churches, caring for the aged and all that sort of thing, caring for widows and orphans. The state has taken more and more of those sort of functions, so there's less and less responsibility on the church. I think the responsibility is still there, but in our present society, I think it would be completely impractical to expect a church to run a pension scheme.